Welcome to the Dr. Bubbs Performance Podcast, giving you the latest evidence-based research and cutting-edge insights for elite mental and physical performance. He's connecting you directly with the world's leading experts and coaches. Here's your host, Dr. Bubbs.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Dr. Bubbs Performance Podcast, evidence-informed, practical-based. This is season 2, episode number 15, and today I'll be talking with former Olympian and performance dietitian Kellyanne Erdman of the Canadian Sport Institute in Calgary. In this episode, Kellyanne is going to discuss the recent joint position statement by the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the Dietitians of Canada, and the American College of Sports Medicine on nutrition and athletic performance. Kellyanne's going to dive into the importance of energy balance and energy availability for athletes, as well as factors that can impact energy availability. She'll also discuss the crucial role of carbohydrates for high-intensity exercise and glycogen's direct and indirect roles in regulating training adaptations. She'll also touch on daily carb requirements depending on your sport, as well as acute fueling strategies in compressed competition windows. She'll talk protein intake ranges and limitations of categorizing athletes as strength or endurance, as well as the role of micronutrients in athletic performance and much, much more. Fantastic insights from Kellyanne in this episode, as well as some great insights and tips from her years and years of experience working with athletes. You can find the link to the research paper discussed here at drbubbs.com/podcast, as well as my layups, the simple actionable tips. If you're interested in more on the role of nutrition in performance, make sure to check out season 1, episode number 49 with Dr. Susan Kleiner, as well as season 1, episode number 25 with Dr. Brad Schoenfeld. Okay, before we get started, a quick word from this episode's sponsor, Totem Sport. Totem Sport is the world's only 100% natural supplement. No sugar, no artificial flavors, absolutely nothing added. Collected from natural algae blooms in the Atlantic Ocean, Totem Sport is the only sports drink supplement that contains all 78 naturally occurring minerals and trace elements. Totem Sport is highly bioavailable and has been shown in the research to enhance stamina by stabilizing blood glucose levels during exercise, as well as strengthening immunity by buffering exercise-induced reductions in key immune markers. The research on deep ocean mineral water is ramping up, a recent study highlighting its major promise as the optimal dehydrating strategy over spring water and other sports drinks. Totem Sport is the evolution of hydration, the world's only 100% natural sport drink, tested and approved by Informed Sport and Informed Choice. Check out totemsport.co.uk and defy the norm. All right, season 2, episode number 15 with Kellyanne Erdman. Enjoy. My guest today is Kellyanne Erdman, performance dietitian at the Canadian Sport Institute in Calgary and contributing author to the recent joint position statement by the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, Dietitians of Canada, and the American College of Sports Medicine on nutrition and athletic performance. Kellyanne, thanks so much for taking the time today.
Oh, good morning, Mark.
Well, listen, can we just maybe kick things off here by just telling us a little bit more about your background and how you got into performance dietetics?
Certainly. So, of course, registered dietitian, a graduate from U of A for my undergrad, and I did my master's at U of C in sports supplements and kinesiology, but originally wanted to study nutrition. I was competitive as an athlete in track and field, and then after high school, I did my first bike race and seemed to be pretty good at it, and next thing you know, I raced for Team Canada for 8 years and Olympian in 92 and 7 world championships. So I always wanted, selfish reasons, wanted to learn how do you fuel a cyclist. And boy, I wish I knew then what I know now. But in the meantime, I've been picking up and working with different high-performance athletes throughout my studies and my career.
That's incredible. I love the next thing you know, you're an Olympian. That's fantastic. Listen, I'd love to dive into this paper here. So many great themes in the paper. We're going to focus on theme number one here, which is nutrition for athletic preparation. So perhaps a good place to start is digging into the concept of energy balance versus energy availability. Can you shed some light on the difference and the importance of the two?
Certainly. So with energy balance, it's simply looking at, is the athlete consuming enough fuel, enough calories to support not only the workouts, but physiological energy required for maintaining good health, immunity, menstrual function, bodily functions. You know, and then in the paper we discuss energy availability, which is a precise calculation. The formula is in there for the readers, where we're looking at specifically then, based on the body composition of the athlete, is there enough energy available for basic physiological functions, and then looking at again enough fueling for training. So the terms are somewhat hand in hand, but the formula that we're using now for energy availability and monitoring physiologically on top of it the athlete's health. So it's a new perspective.
Absolutely, and obviously a lot of this work originally started in female athletes and this kind of lower threshold where we'd start to see, you know, exercise induced dysmenorrhea. You know, where is that kind of low bar then for female athletes when we talk about energy availability?
So, and the thing about energy availability, you're exactly right. Originally, the concern was a female athlete triad where the female doesn't consume enough calories to support the training, or the workouts are just much more than what the athlete has expected, leading to hormonal problems and then bone mineral density. And then the males put up their hand and said, hey, what about us when we don't eat
enough?
For sure. You know, there's events that are happening, immune system, blood composition, so a variety. So we're saying it's not gender specific, but energy availability, as we calculate it in the formula, the bottom line, you want to have at least 40 calories per kg of lean body mass to make sure there's enough fuel, 40 to 45, you know, it's sort of the benchmark that we'd like to aim for. But there's some challenges with that. You have to know the calories expended in the workouts and have a very accurate food record, where it really does include all the foods an athlete eats, so we can calculate their intake.
Absolutely. I mean, great point in terms of obviously the guys experiencing, if they're not getting enough energy in, whether it's strength, endurance, work capacity, immunity, all these things can definitely get impacted. So that's sort of a real foundation for being able to perform. And if we kind of now dig a little bit deeper and get specific on macronutrients, if we talk carbohydrates, which I know these days on social media, et cetera, can be a bit of a polarizing macronutrient. But to lay the foundation here for folks in terms of athletic performance, can you tell us why carbs are so important?
Well, it's interesting, Mark, because it is a hot topic for sure, and different perspectives. What I really like about this paper is our message is one diet doesn't fit all. And the table in this particular paper, table two, really outlines in different situations the amount of carbohydrate that's required for fueling. But more importantly, it's not just carbohydrate for fuel. Of course, we know your brain, central nervous system only uses carbohydrate. So if it's not available, the brain starts to, I explain to athletes, it's like your computer is lagging, and that
sure
affects your technical execution. So it's not just having fuel to be have energy for the muscles. It's how well is your brain working to send those signals to the muscles to concentrate, to focus, to make those split-second decisions. So we look at carbohydrate as that mental, and we call it central fatigue if the athlete's not getting enough and affects the brain, versus peripheral fatigue, meaning the muscles are not being fueled.
Great point in terms of, especially, you know, for us at Canada Basketball team sports in particular, you know, this idea of obviously cognitive function, of being sharp, of being able to make the right decisions at the right times. And as you mentioned, carbohydrate playing such a key role there. Now, if we talk glycogen status, sort of direct and indirect roles of glycogen in regulating muscle adaptations, can you dive into some of the findings there?
Certainly. And with muscle glycogen, of course, that's a stored fuel that's burned in the muscle, and byproduct would be lactate. But it's specific to the muscles that the athlete trains. So if you are a swimmer, you're going to have glycogen throughout the whole body, versus cyclists would be more lower torso heavy for the amount of glycogen that training adaptation over time, the body realizes, well, I'm using these muscles and let's make sure they're fueled effectively in specific muscles that we're using.
And can you give for listeners maybe some examples of some daily carb requirements for different activity levels? You mentioned kind of endurance athletes. If we compared maybe endurance to strength sport athletes, so there's some different general recommendations that you gave in the paper there.
So in the paper on table two, it outlines if an athlete is training for an hour a day, they may only need 3 to 5 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram per day is how we calculate. And then as the exercise volume and or intensity increases, let's face it, whether an athlete is sprinting or lifting weights or whether they're going for a long run, carbohydrate is the preferred fuel. So we would look at, with greater volume and greater intensity, the amount of carbohydrates going upwards of 6 to 10 grams per kilogram per day. And then the higher amounts would be 10 to 12. But there's a lot to be said about athlete efficiency. And if we're working with an elite athlete who's been training for many years, they may find that they're okay with the lower range or even slightly under that to fuel their activity. So there is that efficiency of an athlete as well. But Mark, also in the table, it outlines a summary of carbohydrate before, so what we call now, I call priming versus carbohydrate loading, and how we realize it only takes you 24 to 48 hours to top up those energy reserves. And the table also outlines the recovery, carbohydrates in grams per kilogram, and technically 1 to 1.2 grams per kg in that immediate recovery, two phases would be sufficient to support restoring glycogen.
And what about, Kellyanne, some of those acute fueling strategies? If someone's doing multiple sessions in a day, if they've got a sort of a shorter window of 3 to 4 hours, what are some of the recommendations there in terms of how we can shift carbohydrate intake?
Yeah, absolutely. And typically, though, when an athlete trains twice a day, the coach usually plans that one of the workouts is more exhaustive and the second may be more technical, or it might be a short weight training resistance exercise program. So in most cases, maybe some sports come to mind, rowing, swimming, where they might do back-to-back exhausting workouts in a day. Fair enough.
For sure.
Of course, the acute refueling. And then for some of those athletes, if they're not able, because it really takes 20 to 24 hours to utilize that carbohydrate and restore it back as glycogen. So in that time frame, some of the athletes may actually need some exogenous carbohydrate while they train because they simply haven't had enough time to absorb and retain that and develop that muscle glycogen for that subsequent workout in their day.
Yeah, you guys do a great job in the paper of really describing, as you mentioned, that sort of individualized approach, and depending on the exercise intensities, et cetera, it's really interesting how those doses can change. And if we shift gears here to protein, what were some of the findings on protein intake needs, and can you dive into why this idea of categorizing athletes as, strength versus endurance is often limiting?
Yeah, correct. In previous paper, yes, we had protein for strength and power, and then we had endurance protein requirements. So now the recommendation, 1.2 to 2 grams of protein per kilogram per day overall, with the explanation that in different scenarios, higher protein intakes would be required. For example, if the athlete, let's say I'm working with, for example, speed skaters, and they're off right now, they'll be starting back in a few weeks. So they'll get back to the gym and be doing exercise that's new to their bodies after this period of rest. And so they'll have a higher protein need because now they're breaking down more tissue doing new exercises. So that would be one scenario. Another would be the ultra endurance athlete who is, a substantial amount of breakdown from that ultra endurance event. And then even athletes who are trying to lose body fat, we try to up the protein to prevent wasting of muscle in the process when they're trying to lose weight. So it does outline specific situations when higher protein intakes are warranted. But honestly, Mark, even at 2.0 grams per kilogram per day, most athletes that I work with are consuming well into under 3 grams per kg, even on the higher than the recommended levels.
Yeah, it's often something that I see as well, and sometimes less so in basketball players, but it's definitely a good observation that, going up and above that, we can, apart from, even muscle, we can get some other benefits in terms of immunity and potentially if they're injured as well. So there's a lot of wiggle room there. Now, what about protein timing, Kellyanne? Is there, as a trigger for metabolic adaptations, where does that, how important is that, and what does the evidence say in terms of do we really need to be rushing to have those shakes in? Does it depend on the athlete?
One comment about the paper, Mark, it was published in 2016. So that means the lit review literature review leading into the paper is prior to that. It was published in February 2016. So we're already 3 years out from the update with this paper.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that being said, then there's new information coming out on protein timing, and we're no longer saying consume your branched chain aminos while you train. That's new and it's not in the paper. I just wanted to mention that because we need the athletes to break down. That's the point of overload of training these athletes. So then we do, it is consistent and accurate in the paper to definitely incorporate high quality protein with enough leucine, in particular, the branched chain amino acid, we call the anabolic amino, at least 3 grams of leucine in recovery. So the focus would be, to answer your question, protein is critical in recovery post-workout.
And in terms of the dose then, to get that sort of 3 grams, is it, you know, the standard 20 grams away? Is there some room there, or if someone's going to sort of food options?
It depends on your quality of your protein powder. I've looked at some that tell us in, you know, the product has 25 to 30 grams of protein, but when you look at the breakdown of how much actual leucine is there, sometimes it's under 3 grams. Other good products, it'll be over 3. So you really need to try to get your amino acid composition breakdown from your whey protein powder or your non-whey product. Of course, whey, it is the gold standard just because of the complete protein breakdown, but of course not everyone can tolerate whey, and there's lots of vegan options. And the concern there is, are you getting enough leucine in that product? So really look for the fine print. But overall amount of protein, the most recent literature evidence is saying up to 40 grams, and that is in the paper. We typically say between 20 to 40 grams in recovery.
Fantastic. And you know, we've talked carbohydrates, we've talked proteins, and if we shift over to dietary fats now, if, you know, what exercise intensities are really going to get the most benefit for athletes? Let's say perhaps even more so recreational athletes, but any athletes really, if they're following not even a lower carbohydrate diet, but let's say a lower carb availability training session.
Exactly. And even your elite athletes will purposely plan workouts where they're not, they haven't purposely restored glycogen. I'll work with athletes who purposely restrict the protein because they don't want to put on the muscle. So we look at tweaking the macronutrients to what our desired outcome is from that workout. But yes, there have been situations where we may look at purposely not restoring glycogen so that the athlete is therefore getting into more fat oxidation. But that only happens at the very lowest intensity, because even if you're trying to eat a higher fat, low carb, there's no fuel if you're performing at a high intensity. So we definitely use that for the easy aerobic zone one type training. Some athletes might even exercise in a fasted state so that they're trying to increase fat oxidation. The one we got to be careful, because one consequence, if you do too much training with the high fat and the high fat ketogenic type diet, it can compromise your ability to utilize and store carbohydrates. So we have to watch that. We only do it for a short period of time. And primarily the benefit to that, surprisingly, is aerobic. By following a ketogenic diet, it has an impact on specific enzymes, PGC1-alpha in particular, and that elevates the amount of mitochondria in the cell. So basically that's an aerobic benefit.
Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, timed well, we can get some benefit from that. And as you mentioned, you know, at the elite high level, professional level, elite level, when it comes time to competition day or race day, I mean, carbohydrates are absolutely critical to be when you're competing at those intensities. And this is often something you see in recreational athletes who try to sort of their perhaps training nutrition is the same as their race day nutrition if they're following this a low carb or keto approach, and tend to struggle against the rest of the competition. Now, what about if athletes are, you know, concerned about body composition, and if we talk fat intake, they perhaps drop their fat intake quite low? You know, what are some potential consequences there, and even in terms of micronutrient status?
Certainly. And of course, fat is just like protein. It's an essential nutrient. And if you were to cut the protein out of your diet, you wouldn't be in good health. And the same with fat. Of course, if the dietary fat intake is low in grams, well, you will run the risk of therefore not consuming enough of your omega-3s, essential fatty acids, your inability to absorb fat-soluble vitamins could be compromised. And of course, we know that fat is an essential element of all our cell membranes. So you run the risk of just not maintaining healthy cells. Plus, on the other side, from a food perspective, fat gives us not only flavor and such to our meals and mouthfeel, but it provides satiety, fullness. So someone on a very low-fat diet might find that, oh, no matter what I eat, I'm still hungry. And it's their body's way of saying, I didn't consume enough of an essential nutrient.
Very, very well said. Yeah, that's often something that you definitely see, even more so sometimes with figure competitors or bodybuilders, sometimes when aesthetics are so key and they are dropping fats, and all of a sudden that appetite goes up and the cravings for hyper-palatable foods. Now, you mentioned, obviously, with the fats, fat-soluble vitamins, and you guys in this terrific position stand also discuss micronutrients, vitamin D, iron, calcium, and antioxidants as well. If we dovetail from the fat-soluble vitamins right into the vitamin D, obviously the research here on vitamin D and skeletal muscle has exploded in the last decade or so. Can you summarize some of the beneficial relationships that have been found so far in the research?
Yeah, and unfortunately in this paper, there just wasn't a lot of space. We were limited on our word count and also on the number of references that we can include.
Sure.
So only the really the four key micronutrients were mentioned in a very brief. So in the vitamin D section, we talk about, of course, the importance of vitamin D for calcium absorption and therefore bone health. There's brief mention of vitamin D and metabolic function of muscle, injury prevention, rehabilitation. It doesn't even get into vitamin D and immune system. So it was very limited in what we were able to squeak in there with more of a link to additional references. And definitely the readers would need to go to, I think, a more comprehensive vitamin D review to get a full picture of the current status of what we know with vitamin D and sport performance.
Absolutely. And, if we perhaps talk about, your athletes and what you see in practice with, especially with winter sport athletes, are there certain levels that you tend to see with athletes from that November through to April? Is it supplement strategies that are incorporated? What types of foods perhaps would you emphasize as well? Can you share some of that with folks?
Of course. And I work with primarily winter sports, being Hockey Canada, and also long track speed skating, and of which hockey is definitely indoors year round with their in arenas all the time. But excuse me, if they're wearing sunscreen, you're not producing vitamin D. We did when the national team, I work with the women's team, they were centralized in Calgary starting August leading up to February of our Olympics. And we did one of the first times ever, finally, vitamin D assessment, and a quarter of the team was deficient, being vitamin D levels lower than 80. Ideally, we would want them to be more closer to 100 or higher.
Yep.
We had a quarter of the team lower than 80. So, of course, we had the players on supplements throughout their centralization. However, if you have some athletes, other sports that are able to go to California or Arizona or Florida for training camps.
Yep.
It's a latitude issue. It's a sunlight issue. So that being said, if you're training in the South, in the U.S., you may be okay on vitamin D. But even our cross-country skiers that train not far from Calgary and Canmore, they're outside year-round, except when they go indoors to do their weights. And those athletes have also been shown to have low vitamin D. So it definitely is a latitude issue. And also when we're outside, we're all covered up. So, and then with sunscreen. So vitamin D is definitely something that athletes need to measure in their blood to see where they're at to determine the amount they need to supplement.
Yeah, it's definitely something similar with Canada basketball. Obviously, basketball players are indoors most of the time as well. And so it's amazing how even in the summer months, a lot of our players, whether it's frank deficiencies, insufficiencies, or just at inadequate levels to really sort of support that performance. And of course, things like egg yolks and deep cold water fatty fish, and some mushrooms can help you out a little bit. But obviously, in the dog days of winter, sometimes some supplementation, a couple thousand IU, could be highly beneficial as well. Now, if we shift gears to calcium, I think most people would immediately say, at least athletes would remember, that calcium is important for bones. But can you talk about some other areas of importance for athletic performance?
Of course, and calcium is involved in regulation of muscle contractions, for your nerves to conduct effectively. So calcium is critical on musculoskeletal function beyond bone density. So definitely critical what we're looking at, and the form of calcium in the diet. I caution athletes on looking at their full dietary intakes. This is one micronutrient that doesn't need to necessarily be supplemented, such as vitamin D, but we would look at full dietary intake, the form of calcium. Calcium, of course, as a mineral, it's competitive for absorption with other minerals like iron. So often the timing of when an athlete would take their calcium would be separate from when they might have to supplement with other minerals like iron. So we would look at diet first, and if there's a shortage, then let's make sure we're topping up. Now, the signs of this one, Mark, it's hard to tell for an athlete. From my experience, if someone is low in calcium, they may find it more so when they're sleeping, they get muscle cramps or restless leg syndrome. It may not be as apparent while they're exercising if they have a deficiency.
That's great. Great clinical pearl there for sure. And how does energy availability impact things like calcium status? Is there a connection there?
Certainly, and even more so with iron. If an athlete does not consume enough calories, so i.e. energy is not available for basic physiological functions, we tend to see the micronutrients that are compromised would be the top three that were listed in the position paper. Iron, vitamin D, and calcium would be the micronutrients that first come to mind that we would often find. Now, one thing to monitor too, if energy is not available, and for females, if it compromises their menstrual function where they're missing some cycles or months without having menstrual cycles, we'll in fact do a bone mineral density scan to see is that lack of energy available, is that compromising their calcium to the point that it's affecting bone density, bone mineral density.
Absolutely. That's definitely something where that's when you know that there's a frank lack of not only energy availability, but obviously the calcium. And so that's great to have those screening tools. And of course, as you mentioned, perhaps for some field-based practitioners, coaches, et cetera, if they don't have access to these things, then as you mentioned, if menstrual dysfunction, even the leg cramps in the evening can be ways of potentially seeing some of this early signs before we get into the bone mineral issues. You touched on iron there. I think oftentimes, again, people would associate iron with more female health, female athletic health versus male. Can you go over some of the key importance of iron levels in terms of its capacity to help support athletic performance?
Certainly, and iron, of course, one of the main functions that we look at on the performance side of things is the oxygen carrying capacity that iron is required. So that definitely has an aerobic link to it. But we've certainly outlined in the paper situations where iron may need to be supplemented, especially if the athlete is training at altitude over basically 3,000 meters. Rapid growth. I see that a lot with adolescent athletes. Basketball players would come to mind.
Sure.
They're just going through a huge growth. And, of course, it's not just hemoglobin where we need the iron. It's myoglobin when the muscles are growing. The other situation would be iron is, of course, lost in our sweat. And so if someone does a lot, is a heavy sweater, they could actually be losing a fair bit of iron in their sweat. And then another situation, Mark, would be runners. When on impact under your foot, you can destroy red blood cells, as well as iron is lost through the gut. Just the impact, the jarring motion of running, or any athletes that do running as part of their training, basketball, volleyball, cross-country skiers run, my speed skaters run, any athlete who's running could be losing some iron through the gut. So it's definitely a mineral of concern. for both males and females.
Yeah, very well said, and absolutely in terms of just ensuring that that food-first approach, we're getting all those foods that are iron-rich in terms of the animal proteins and darker cuts of meat, et cetera, that can provide that is, as you mentioned, just so critical for all athletes. And now if we shift gears a little bit to the antioxidants, and of course, you know, they play a key role in protecting cell membranes from oxidative damage, and increase, and obviously exercise can increase oxygen consumption, you know, upwards of 10 to 15 fold. So, you know, athletes under chronic oxidative stress, you know, can you unpack this a little bit for folks? How does the body's antioxidant defense deal with this?
Yeah, interesting. And again, the body is an amazing machine, and there's a natural adaptation over time that the body builds its own natural defense mechanism to be able to clear the free radicals that we produce through this oxidative stress. If you and I don't know how fit, super fit you are, Mark, but if you and I were...
Used to be fitter, Kellyanne.
If we were to jump into a program of 20-plus hours a week of aerobic exercise, yeah, we'd be really suffering from that oxidative stress. And over time, though, our bodies would say, okay, I'm getting used to this. I'm learning how to clear these free radicals. And so the antioxidants, interesting topic. We no longer recommend supplementation with antioxidants during times of stress, and that's simply because it can actually lead to pro-oxidative damage. So now instead, what we're encouraging the athletes is bright colors, like just choose your foods that contain all the pigments, all the bright colors, so that you're more likely to consume foods that are rich in the antioxidants to build your natural defense mechanism.
Terrific, terrific insights there in terms of that. Yeah, the supplementation with antioxidants, especially after training, being, you know, blunting those adaptations to training, and people get caught in that mindset of, you know, inflammation bad, and sort of not realizing that these, as you mentioned, are natural processes, and if we blunt them or derange them, then we don't get that adaptive response that we're actually trying to achieve with all this training. So very well said there. And if we think about athletes that maybe are at the greatest risk for having a poor antioxidant intake, are there certain categories that would coaches, practitioners should be cognizant of?
Oh, definitely. And I'm sure we've all seen the athlete who has an aversion to groups of foods, just doesn't like vegetables, a very picky eater. It could also be a situation where someone is intolerant or actually has food allergies and is restricting, having to restrict particular foods and lists of foods that they seem not to be able to tolerate. Another situation would be someone who's purposely under eating, hypocaloric intake, trying to lose some body fat, either purposely or just, accidentally not eating enough. When we don't eat enough, it can certainly compromise our micronutrient status, and antioxidants would be of concern for sure.
Terrific. Yeah, it's definitely one. I think folks who are in sports where there's, again, weight cutting or aesthetics, it's definitely a potential area of concern. So one to flag as well for coaches and listeners. Now, if we shift gears a little bit here, Kellyanne, to the personal side of things, I know you're obviously very busy with your work at the Canadian Sport Institute. Can you give folks a little glimpse into your daily routine? How does your day start? Do you train in the morning? Is it coffee? Is it straight into the institute?
I tend to unwind in my days with my activity later in the day and get going with the sports first thing. But I do a variety of things with athletes, individual consultations, going to just hanging out at training sessions. That's when often the athletes will come up and chat, hey, what about this? What about that? So just those informal drop-ins, you just are very important, building that rapport with the athletes and the coaches so that they feel comfortable to come up at any time and ask about nutrition-related items. I think it's also really important when I work with a lot of the coaches and we'll have one-on-one meetings with the coaches. Let's face it, they're with the athletes the most. They are, my eyes to assess situations. What are they seeing with the athletes? You know, is one of their athletes not recovering, and what does that mean? Are they just busy studying for exams, or maybe they're having some food issues? So I talk to the coaches a lot to see how are individual athletes doing, how is the team doing, and how are they responding to the specific training load. So a lot of my day would be hanging out in the gym, at the rink, on the ice, and just with the teams, with the athletes, and then individual support as well as workshops. But at the elite level, I tend to do much more one-on-one or small training group workshops where we really focus. We'll spend an hour just talking about nutrition and recovery or nutrition and altitude training. So the very specific topics when I work with athletes and teams.
Such a great point there of being able to these sort of informal drop-ins, being able to hang around when athletes are training and practice and building some relationships, building some connectivity with athletes and coaches so that it becomes a more of a two-way street and easy communication. And as you mentioned there, the coach is really the eyes and ears, so they're able to, as well as even the athlete feedback, to provide you with some of those insights that sometimes get left out of one-to-one visits or unbeknownst to the practitioner. You think, geez, how could you not have mentioned that when it's such an important thing? So I think that's a really, really great point there. And of course, if I could ask you here, no difficult question, but if you could give coach, practitioners, dietitians, nutritionists listening in, sort of one overarching nutrition tip, that 20% of the fundamentals for supporting athletic performance. I know a very difficult question here, but, what might that be? What's one of those big rocks that's really going to help people to support athletic performance?
I would say, Mark, often I find that athletes are not eating often enough. There's too many gaps in their day where they're missing, I don't need that morning snack, but then it catches up with them later in the day. So I really focus on the frequency of when an athlete is eating to support pre-workout recovery. But beyond that, in their full day, are they eating often enough to get the quality nutrition? Of course, the timing pre and post. And then I definitely find that sometimes coaches forget how often athletes need to eat. And I've been working with UFC Dinos men's basketball team, and they just won Canadian championships, or CIS.
They did.
First time in 50 years. And I just sent a message to the coach when they were, of course, dietitian didn't travel, but they were in Halifax at the championships. And coach just, I had reached out and said, so how's the food going? And he says to me, yeah, we're getting all these preset meals, buffet style. And my response to him was, okay, that's great, but go out and buy more food. Don't forget, your players need to eat mini meals for snacks, and let's keep them fueled. And, lo and behold, they win the gold medal in the end. So, again, I really do stress eating often.
Phenomenal tip there, Kellyanne. That's definitely one where that frequency is just such a key one in terms of helping to achieve that energy balance or energy availability. All of a sudden, protein goes up, everything starts to work in your favor. So that's a great tip. And as you mentioned, when teams are traveling, you get to those buffet scenarios, but what's happening in between those meals and the snacks become crucial. So fantastic insights here. Thanks so much for taking the time, Kellyanne. Where can people, stay connected with you and your work and your research?
That would be through Canadian Sport Institute, and that's Kay Erdman at csicalgary.ca. I certainly answer questions or do Skype consults from athletes across the country.
Fantastic. Well, again, thanks so much for joining in. We'll definitely include those links with the podcast summary in the show notes at drbubs.com/podcast. Thanks again for everyone else tuning in. If you have any questions for Kellyanne or want to leave a comment on today's episode, you can reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Dr. Bubs. And of course, if you enjoy the show, please head over to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, whatever your preferred app is, subscribe and share with friends. Thanks, everyone, and see you guys all next week.
The Dr. Bubs Performance Podcast endeavors to provide accurate and helpful information to listeners. These podcasts cannot take into account individual circumstances and are not intended to be a substitute for health and medical advice from a qualified health professional. You should always seek the advice of a qualified health professional before acting on any of the information provided by any of the Dr. Bubs Performance Podcasts.